Okay, so you've been digging into the history of worship in ancient Israel, and wow, you've found some really fascinating stuff.
Yeah, it's a pretty rich topic.
It is. We've got all these scholarly articles, biblical commentaries, even lecture notes here from a scholar named Robert Van Noy. Looks like you're trying to figure out like this big question: did ancient Israelite religion always require worship in one central place, like the temple in Jerusalem? Or was that like something that developed later on?
That's a great question, and it's something that scholars have been wrestling with for a long time. The answer, as you've probably already figured out, isn't exactly simple.
Right. And it seems like a lot of this whole debate really goes back to Julius Wellhausen. He's that 19th century scholar, right? Like his ideas kind of shaped how everyone thinks about biblical studies even today.
Yeah, definitely. Wellhausen's theory was basically that ancient Israelite religion evolved over time.
Okay, so like it started out kind of decentralized, right? With lots of different altars everywhere.
Exactly. Multiple places of worship, not just one central location.
And then over time, Wellhausen says it kind of shifted to a centralized system, with the temple in Jerusalem becoming the main focus.
Right. It's like he saw it as a timeline, you know.
Yeah.
Things started simple and gradually became more complex.
Yeah, that makes sense. But then, I mean, obviously not everyone agreed with Wellhausen.
Oh, absolutely not.
Yeah.
There have been other scholars who've looked at the evidence and, well, they came to some very different conclusions. In your research, you found B. Halwarda, for example.
Yeah, the Dutch scholar. And like, he really takes Wellhausen to task.
He does. Halwarda seems to be saying that this whole debate really comes down to how we define centralized worship. Like, that's the key to figuring this all out.
Okay, so it's not just about whether there were multiple altars or not, but about what centralized worship really meant in that context.
Exactly. And by questioning Wellhausen's assumptions, Halwarda forces us to take a fresh look at everything. It's a reminder that how we interpret those historical and religious texts, it can lead to very different understandings.
So how does Halwarda challenge Wellhausen's theory? Like, what's his take on all this?
Well, he starts by looking at all the evidence we have from those historical books of the Bible, you know, the ones that cover the time of the judges, all the way up to the establishment of the kingdom. Those books, they mention a lot of different altars being used all over the place.
So even in the Bible itself, we see people worshiping at different altars, and it wasn't necessarily a bad thing.
It doesn't seem to have been, at least not always,
Yeah.
but we do have to acknowledge that there are also examples of unacceptable worship in the Bible.
Okay, yeah. Like Micah setting up idols in his house. That's in Judges 17. We're
That's one
looking there.
example. Or Jeroboam making those golden calves. That's in 1 Kings 12. These instances, though, they're contrasted with other times when the Bible doesn't condemn worship happening at altars outside of, you know, the central sanctuary.
So it's not as simple as saying all altars were good or all altars were bad. There were some that were okay and others that were definitely not okay. What made the difference?
Well, that's a question that's kept scholars busy for a long time. Was it the location of the altar, the kind of worship happening there,
Yeah.
or something else altogether? It's hard to say for sure.
It's complicated. You know, one story that really stands out to me is the one about Elijah on Mount Carmel. Here's this prophet. He builds an altar up on a mountain, and this is long after the temple in Jerusalem had been built, right?
Right, the temple was already established.
And yet, it seems like God totally approves of what Elijah's doing. You even have that dramatic scene with fire coming down from heaven. It makes you wonder if,
Yeah.
you know, maybe having just one central altar wasn't the only acceptable way to worship back then.
Yeah, that's a really important point. The story of Elijah, it really challenges that neat linear progression that Wellhausen talked about. And if you look a little further in 1 Kings 19, Elijah actually complains about the destruction of altars, not about there being too many of them. So that suggests, you know, that maybe having multiple altars wasn't the real problem.
So maybe it was more about what was happening at some of those altars, not just the fact that there were a lot of them, like were they being used for things that went against like the core beliefs of Israelite religion?
That's a key distinction.
Yeah.
Take the high places, for instance. They were these elevated areas that people often used for worship. But some of them, they were connected to Canaanite practices, which were a big no-no for the Israelites. But then you have other high places that seem to have been perfectly fine for worshiping Yahweh, you know, the God of Israel.
So it's like we have to look at each situation individually. Not all altars were the same. And even those high places, which sometimes get a bad rap, they weren't all bad. Some were okay, some weren't. It's kind of like trying to put together a puzzle where you're missing some of the pieces.
Exactly. And to make things even more complicated, you have figures like the prophet Samuel. He was a major figure in Israelite religion. And he built and sacrificed at multiple altars himself. And the Bible doesn't present that as being a problem at all.
Yeah, that's true. If you look at 1 Samuel, you see him doing sacrifices in all sorts of places. Chapters 7, 9, 11, and 16 all describe this. And it's portrayed as just a normal part of his religious practice.
And it goes beyond just Samuel. Like when he goes to anoint David, he uses a sacrifice as an excuse. It's like it was so commonplace that nobody would even think twice about it.
And then there's that part in 1 Samuel 20 where David has to leave King Saul's dinner table to go to a sacrifice in Bethlehem. It's like all these examples, they point to a very different picture of religious practice than the one Wellhausen laid out. It seems a lot more flexible.
Right. So we're seeing how Hawarda uses both those scriptural examples and, you know, what we know about the historical context to suggest a system that was more decentralized, more fluid than what Wellhausen proposed. But of course, this raises a big question. How do we square this idea of multiple acceptable places of worship with those passages in the Bible that seem to say you have to have just one sanctuary, like Deuteronomy 12?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Deuteronomy 12 seems pretty clear about needing one designated spot. How does Hawarda deal with that?
Well, this is where things get even more interesting. Hawarda offers a whole new way of reading Deuteronomy 12. But before we get into that, there's another piece of the puzzle we need to consider.
Okay, now you've got me hooked. What is it?
Let's take a look at Exodus 20.24.26. It's often called the law of the altar. It says that altars should be made of earth or uncut stones, and it really seems to imply that they were intended for ongoing use in Canaan. Not just during that time when the Israelites were wandering in the wilderness.
Wait a minute. So that goes against the whole idea of having just one central altar, right? If they were supposed to be building altars all over the place, how does that fit with the idea of centralized worship?
That's the key point. The law of the altar seems to be saying that having multiple altars was expected even after they settled in Canaan. This creates a real challenge for anyone who believes that ancient Israelite religion was strictly centralized.
So how did Wellhausen explain that then? How did he deal with this apparent contradiction between Exodus 20, which seems to be okay with multiple altars, and Deuteronomy 12, which emphasizes a single sanctuary?
He said that those texts represent different stages in a long process of religious evolution. So early on, he says, multiple altars were common. But as time passed, the focus shifted to a centralized system. And those rules in Deuteronomy 12, they were like the culmination of that process.
Yeah.
But what if we've been misreading Deuteronomy 12 all along? What if there's another way to understand that text?
Okay, now you've really got me curious. I want to hear what Hawarda has to say about this. Okay, so like Deuteronomy 12, that seems to be the strongest argument for saying there should only be one sanctuary. How does Hawarda even start to, you know, reinterpret that?
Well, he suggests that maybe we've been reading it wrong this whole time. Like, instead of assuming that Deuteronomy 12 contradicts all this other evidence for multiple altars, what if it actually doesn't? He points to a key verse, Deuteronomy 12.14. It says, but in the place which the Lord shall choose in one of your tribes, there you shall offer your burnt offerings.
Yeah, I see why people would interpret that as meaning like one specific spot, right? It seems pretty straightforward.
It does, at first glance. But Hawarda says, hang on, let's look closer at the actual words. The phrase, one of your tribes, he argues, doesn't necessarily mean only one. It could also mean any one of the tribes.
Oh, okay. So it could be saying, like, in the place which the Lord shall choose in any one of your tribes.
Right. And that opens up the possibility that there could be multiple places, each within a different tribe, that God has chosen.
That would change things quite a bit. But even if we accept that, what about the phrase, in the place? That still sounds like we're talking about one specific location, doesn't it?
That's another thing Hawarda addresses. He explains that in biblical Hebrew, those singular nouns that have definite articles, like the place in this verse, they can actually have what's called a distributive meaning. It's not always restricted to just one thing.
Okay, so in simpler terms, it doesn't have to limit things to just one single spot.
Exactly. And Hawarda actually gives several examples of this from other parts of the Bible.
That would be helpful, yeah. It's a little hard to wrap my head around this just in the abstract.
Sure, so one example he gives is from Numbers 16.7. It says, the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the one who is holy. Now, grammatically, the man is singular.
Mm.
But in the context of that story, it's actually referring to either Moses and Aaron or a group of 250 men.
Oh, I see. So even though it says the man, it could be more than one person.
Exactly. It's not excluding that possibility. And there are other examples, too. Like in Ezekiel 18.4, it says, the soul that sins shall die. Again, The soul is singular, but it's obviously talking about any soul that sins, not just one specific person.
Right, right. It's like when we say something like, the student who studies hard will succeed. We don't mean only one student in the whole world will succeed, do we?
Exactly. And Hawarda points to a couple more verses too, like Deuteronomy 18.6 and 23.17, where it talks about the Levite and the slave. In both cases, it's singular, but it means any Levite and any slaves.
So putting all this together, if we follow Hawarda's interpretation, when Deuteronomy 12.14 says the place, it could actually be talking about multiple places that God chose, like within those different tribes.
That's exactly his point. And this interpretation really helps us make sense of those seemingly contradictory passages, like Exodus 20, which is to allow for multiple altars, and Deuteronomy 12, which seems to require a single sanctuary. Hawarda is saying they actually fit together quite nicely.
It's amazing to think that this whole debate might come down to like a subtle little point of Hebrew grammar. It shows how important it is to, you know, really dig into those ancient texts and pay attention to every detail.
Absolutely. It highlights how complex it is to interpret those ancient texts.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds us that sometimes those little linguistic details, they can lead to some really big insights.
So if Hawarda is right, I mean, what does that mean for how we understand worship in ancient Israel? Does it totally change the picture?
It suggests that things might have been a lot more flexible than we traditionally thought. You know, it might have been a system where there were multiple locations that were considered legitimate places to offer sacrifices to Yahweh, as long as those places met certain criteria, of course.
Okay, so more decentralized.
Right. But if that's the case, why did the temple in Jerusalem eventually become so central? Like, why did it end up being the main focus of worship?
That's a good question. Like, even if there were multiple places that were okay, the temple in Jerusalem still became, you know, the big one.
That's true. It's definitely true that the temple became the main focus, especially after King Josiah's reforms in the 7th century BCE. But even before that, you know, even when the temple was standing, there were times when people just couldn't make the trip to Jerusalem.
Right, like during wars or if there was some kind of political upheaval, it would have been too dangerous or maybe even impossible to travel.
Exactly. And in those situations, it seems like worshiping at other locations, you know, maybe those places that have been sanctioned in that way that's described in Deuteronomy 12, it wasn't necessarily seen as going against religious law.
It's interesting to think that, you know, ancient Israelite religion wasn't just this like monolithic, unchanging thing. It seems like their practices and their ideas about worship, they changed over time and they were influenced by all sorts of things that were happening in the world around them.
Absolutely. It's a good reminder that we need to think about the historical context and we should try to avoid those oversimplified interpretations of ancient religions.
You know, what really strikes me is how much our understanding of these ancient practices can shift over time. New scholarship, new perspectives, they can open up entirely new ways of reading and understanding those texts that we thought we knew so well.
That's one of the best things about studying history and religion. It's a constant conversation, you know. It's always evolving, always changing, always discovering something new.
It reminds us that we should never just stop questioning, you know. We should always be exploring and be willing to change our minds about things we thought we knew. So we've gone from Wellhausen's idea of a linear progression towards centralized worship to this more nuanced, more decentralized model that Hawarda proposes. It's fascinating how one scholar's challenge can totally change the way we think about a long-held assumption.
Right. And we should keep in mind that this is just one interpretation. There are other scholars who offer different perspectives on this whole debate. It's an ongoing conversation.
And that's what I love about these deep dives, you know. They challenge your assumptions, make you think critically, and they make you want to keep learning and exploring.
And speaking of exploring further, there's another interesting angle to all of this that we haven't even touched on yet.
Oh, now I'm really intrigued. What is it?
Well, it has to do with that phrase, the place which the Lord shall choose. What did it mean for God to choose a place, you know, back in ancient Israel? And how would the Israelites know where these divinely sanctioned locations actually were?
Wow, those are great questions. I'm all ears. Okay, so we've been talking about how the Israelites, like, they believed God could be worshipped at multiple places, but God also, like, chose certain places, right? So I guess, like, what did that actually mean, that God chose a place? Like, did God actually, you know, live there?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It gets at the heart of how the ancient Israelites thought about God's presence. It's not so much that God was like stuck in one specific location, but more that certain places were considered, you know, more special, more holy, maybe more conducive to experiencing the divine. It's actually an idea you find in a lot of religions, this concept of sacred space.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So it's like some places are sort of like gateways or portals or something to the divine realm.
Yeah.
Where like the line between human and divine gets kind of blurry.
Yeah, I like that. It wasn't just any random spot on the map. Mm-hmm. These places, they were thought to be like points where humanity could more easily connect with the divine. But that still leaves us with the question, how did the Israelites know which places God had chosen?
Right, exactly. Like, was there some ancient Israelite version of, like, a divine GPS telling them where to go?
Uh-huh. That's a good question. And unfortunately, the sources don't really give us, like, a clear-cut answer. But there are definitely clues scattered throughout those biblical texts, like hints that maybe suggest different ways God's choice might have been revealed.
Okay, so what kind of clues are we talking about?
One possibility is through those events that scholars call theophanies. Mm-hmm. Those are like those visible manifestations of God. You know, like the burning bush that Moses saw, or that pillar of cloud and fire that led the Israelites in the wilderness.
Oh, wow, yeah. Those are pretty hard to miss, huh?
Exactly. Those kinds of experiences, they're awe-inspiring,
right?
So they could be interpreted as God, like designating that spot as sacred, a place where he was present and, you know, willing to be encountered.
So sometimes God made his presence known in a way that was pretty dramatic and unmistakable, but I'm guessing those kinds of theophanies didn't happen every day, did they? So were there other ways God might have, like, communicated his choice?
Yeah, you're right. Those big dramatic events were probably pretty rare. So we have to consider other possibilities. For instance, God might have chosen to reveal his choice for a place of worship through prophetic pronouncements.
Mm.
You know, prophets were often seen as like intermediaries between God and the people. They delivered God's messages and instructions.
Oh, that makes sense. So a prophet could just say, hey, God told me this place is special. We should worship here. And people would accept that.
Most likely, yeah. And you also see times in the biblical text where something good happens, like a military victory or, I don't know, maybe a good harvest or something. And the people, they interpret it as like a sign of God's favor. And that would lead them to believe that the place where it happened, you know, that spot was specially blessed by God.
So it wasn't always like one clear sign. It could be all these different things, a theophany, a prophetic message, what was happening in their lives, good or bad. It sounds like they were really looking for any confirmation they could get that God had chosen a particular place.
That's a really good point. It shows how much religion was just like woven into their daily lives. They saw God's hand in everything.
This deep dive has been amazing. I mean, we started with Wellhausen's theory, that whole linear progression towards centralized worship. Then we dug into Hawarda's ideas, which presented a much more nuanced picture, right? More decentralized, less rigid. And now we've even gotten into these questions of divine presence and sacred space. Really made me think about all this in a whole new way.
It's been great exploring all this with you. And the best part is, like, this isn't the end of the conversation. There's always more to learn about the history of worship in ancient Israel. New research and discoveries, they happen all the time.
That's what I love about these deep dives. They remind you that learning is like a never-ending journey. There's always something new to discover. So to everyone listening, don't stop asking questions, keep searching, and keep digging deeper.